This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Philip C and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. On today's Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Maimuna Mohammed Sharif, United Nations Under Secretary General and Executive Director of UN Habitat, who we affectionately call here as ED, and Dr. Matt Benson, a Program Director for Think City, and is a member of the International Advisory Board for the World Cities Report 2020, as we discuss how global urbanization has evolved as we exit out from the pandemic. A very good morning to you, ED and Matt. Such a timely conversation to have as we enter out from the pandemic. And most of our listeners are live in the city, they're commuting, they're cursing in the traffic jams now, and they're really asking themselves how livable cities are. Where have we succeeded the most and where have we failed the most?
Yeah, thank you so much, Philip, for having me here. And as you said, that is at the moment now the talk, not only at the Malaysia, also globally, the role of cities in looking into the impact of COVID and impact of climate change, impact of urban crisis to the livelihood of the people. That's why the vision of the UN Habitat strategic plan is to promote a better quality of life for all. All here is not only human, it's also for fauna and flora, for all in the urbanizing world. Because why urbanizing world? I think we will continue to urbanize. And in our World Cities Report, which launched recently in Poland, urbanization is there to continue.
Despite it's here to stay. You can't run away from it, right?
Yes.
It's not a policy you can reverse.
Yes. But it's how we plan. Well-planned, well-managed cities, I think, will make a difference in the livelihood of the people.
So I guess then the broader question, and I want to bring you in to the discussion, Matt. Mm-hmm. When you think about better urban planning, have we changed the way we do urban planning, you know, before and post-pandemic?
Well, I think there are a few enduring trends as a result of the pandemic when it comes to urban planning and how we think about cities. I mean, the first point I would say is to build on Edie's comment, which is cities are still going to matter. Urbanization is going to continue. Africa, Asia is where a big part of the future urban population is going to reside. In terms of the urban planning, I think what we've seen the doubling down and the enhancement of some of the concepts that are already out there. So, for example, the 20-minute city is something that sort of become currency during the pandemic, but it's not a new idea. That's an old idea, or 15-minute city. We started to see concepts around the 5-minute city come out of the pandemic. That's sort of neighbourhoods that could have access to the majority of their services within a 5-minute walk. And I think there's a concept here we might be able to apply to PPR flat in Malaysia. But generally speaking, I think the lasting legacy of the pandemic on urban planning is actually around the form of cities. So in other words, I think there will be, and we've seen strong evidence in Australia and other Western countries, and I think we're going to start to see it more in Malaysia, where people actually look into the intermediate cities, Taipei, Ipoh, even Johor and Penang, as alternatives to KL, as people kind of go, well, I can work from home, you know, digital technology, etc. I can now choose my city as much as I can choose my job. So that's the enduring impact on urban planning.
So that's why I was thinking about this, right? If you reflect about a decade ago, we always like think a country as like one capital city, like one central point where everybody converges. But what I hear a lot now is that we're very multinodal, that actually a country has many multiple cities, that there's a dispersion taking place. We're not seeing essentially the city sprawl into a suburb, but actually a flourishing of multiple smaller cities taking place all around the country. Is that trend going to stick around the world?
Yeah, around the world. I think recently in Africa, I'll share with you, there's a conference by AFRI Cities. The theme is on the role of intermediary cities. And because now COVID-19 and all this pandemic and climate change, people are trying to move out from the city centre. And at the same time, with the technology, with the infrastructure available now, but we need to plan well these intermediary cities so that it won't repeat the same inverted comma mistake that is already in the capital. We need to really looking into the new model of urban design, and that if it's new areas, that is retrofit for the intermediary cities. We don't call it secondary cities. Intermediary cities.
Intermediary.
Like for example, Penang, Taiping, Ipoh. So we have to plan well.
So then I guess the broader question in my mind is, you know, bringing back to the Malaysian theme, like for many of us who think of KL as the core city, but then we have all these satellite towns. brands like Patalingjaya and such, right, and Klang that flourish around the major primary city. Is that going to be the theme now, as opposed to what you're saying, which is there are these three, four major nodes like Penang, JB, KL, but there are also smaller intermediary cities around but further away? Which is the right kind of model we're seeing take place here than in Malaysia?
Well, I don't think there's necessarily a right model per se. It would be folly to think to pigeonhole yourself into a prescriptive solution. But I agree. What we're seeing is definitely a shift away from what we call a monocentric, monocentric. So a single city centre with everybody commutes into. That's sort of the American model of cities. And to be fair, Kuala Lumpur in particular has actually not really ever been that. It's always been a more polycentric, multiple-centric city structure. And I think what we will see in the future is in those bigger capital cities, the enhancement of those poly centres. You know, as people are increasingly working from home or at least 3 days a week in the office, those neighbourhood centres, which is where a lot of the local economic development is going to happen. And I think we will see a revival of suburban centres as much as we see the revival of the intermediate cities as well, as this counter-urbanisation trend. I was told by my communications, but not to use jargon, but I'm going to use it anyway. Counter-urbanisation, which is sort of the opposite of from rural to city, we're going to increasingly see this trend of people moving from city to rural, or at least the intermediate township. So we need to come up with a term. We talk about sustainable urbanisation, maybe we need to talk about sustainable counter-urbanisation.
Yeah, because if you look into that, the intermediate cities, that we have to be self-sustained. That is very important. And then now the new thinking of self-sustaining, then with new innovation and with new technology, I think we, as you said, that we are working from home now. So we don't need to go to the city. Last time you want to get a job, you have to go to the city centre. So now we can stay in this satellite town or intermediate cities, but still you can do your work and you reduce the commuting to the city centre and also reduce the pressure and the challenges of the city centre.
This is the risk I sense, because you talk about a concept or even a theme that's relatively fluid, this work from home. Because if you talk to many of our listeners here, they are like cursing and swearing, heading to the office now, because many businesses are now demanding them to return back to the office. So the question I have is that, you know, cities have to respond to these very shifting dynamics and trends, which can go one way or the other very fast. How do you then build resilience and agility in city planning? Because when I think of urban planning, it's essentially like a map with very clear infrastructure plans where things are very much concrete. How do you infuse agility and flexibility in the city planning to make sure that it is adaptive to all these very, very, very fast changing trends?
I think that's why we are now moving, even in the global and also in Malaysia and many other countries, we are moving from zoning planning now. In the 80s, when I just started as an urban planner last time, we put a zone as commercial, residential, industry, tourism, then connected by road, by that. But now we are talking about mixed city. We're talking about compact city. We're talking about 15-minute city. And today, this morning, we said, well, it may be in certain areas with 5-minute city instead of 15-minute. Why we need 15? So these are the new thinking at the moment coming back. To me, is that what we would like to see is that whether whatever design, whatever new form, whether we improve the quality of the livelihood of the people. And for example, like you say that whether working from home is reasonable, but in the UN, and I also received a few feedback from my colleague. He said, you said it's working from home is good, but 50% of the global population is offline. And then
they don't have the luxury to work from home.
They don't. Even in UN Habitat, few of my colleagues say that we need to go, ED, we need to go to the office because my internet is not stable.
Yes.
And I have to, my kids have to be at home because it's homeschooling. And then I have no support system. So sometimes there is a need to bring back the people to the office and also for face-to-face.
Yes. I mean, there's some benefits of face-to-face. But, you know, ED brings a very interesting point that if 50% of the world is not connected, I'm sure urban planning in developed locations or developed world is very different from urban planning in emerging world. There is a big contrast there, isn't it? So do you see a convergence or divergence in how we do urban planning then? Because perhaps, you know, I'm going to bring ED in to give the global picture, but especially in Malaysia, when we see these different concepts of the satellite towns kind of work, but you also have these intermediate cities. How do you see this challenge we have, right? That not everybody is connected, not everybody has equal access. How do cities then respond to that?
Look, my quick response here, that's kind of building on ED's comments there about the need to have different solutions for different places.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned the word adaptability and agility before. So I think the key here is not to be dogmatic, not to be sort of ideological about our planning responses. We've shifted from zoning, you know, sort of in planning in zones and, you know, here's the yellow line and only certain things, because the world doesn't like it. It's not like that. You know, residential, you know, what is residential? People are, you know, running business from home. So we need to have, I guess, my main point here is we need to have policy frameworks and a policy mindset that is flexible, that is adaptive, that can respond to new information as it comes to light. And we've seen that with the pandemic. If you didn't have a flexible and responsive government to deal with the increasing uncertainties that were coming down the chute, right, we would have been stuck in a model and you know, not be able to move out. Mm. So we need mindsets and policies and planning framework that can deal with new information, can also respond to local circumstance. This is the key, right? Because every place has its own unique sense of place. Every place is got its own special qualities. And we need to be able to have, we have our framing and our principles, but we need to be able to adapt to local conditions and circumstance.
And that's why local conditions is a very interesting take, because when I hear the consistent themes, they're very common, right, in terms of the local conditions. It's just adapted to the local conditions, but they have very much a global context. Take, for instance, climate change. I mean, this whole summer has been a wake-up call for many countries around the world. You look at floods in Seoul. I've never seen something like that, or even the wildfires in Spain. So I wonder then, how do cities plan in view of really, honestly, something inevitable, which is climate change, but the outcome is so ambiguous and not clear, because nobody expected a flood in Seoul.
I would like to answer this in two portions. One is that the need to have an integrated and a holistic land use planning when you talk about climate change. I brought this in Glasgow when I was invited for the COP26 to speak at four occasions. We need to look at climate change with sustainable urbanization in one ecosystem. Even the how much funding that you put to mitigate the climate change, if you don't make your cities right, then you will be only pouring a lot of funding to going nowhere. So holistic, integrated between what happened to the land and to happen to the sea, and also the policy had to be integrated. That's one. Second is that I believe in people-centered. COVID-19 shows that everything is about people. So when you talk about climate change, people, the vulnerable society is the most important. I just came back from World City Summit in Singapore. I would like to share this. Mayor of Cape Town, we are talking about decarbonization in terms of climate change. And he put it very right on the table. He said that, you asked me not to stop using coal. If I stop using coal, 90% of my people will be unemployed. There is no alternative. Second, you asked me not to use coal for cooking. If there is no food, my people will be hungry. So he said, is there any affordable alternative when you talk about the developed countries and the least developed countries? So when you talk about climate change in the least developed countries or developing countries, it's a different discussion.
Yeah, but it's such a difficult dimensions to balance, right, all this.
Yes, but when you talk about in the global north, it's different. So they say that we only use around less than 2% of our carbon footprint, but you are the one who using private jet, using helicopter, using that. So you already, now you ask us to reduce, to decarbonize. So he said that to find the balance in terms of this, I think that is, we have to go back to the people in order to be inclusive, in order to be resilient. So people is very important.
On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Maimouna Mohammed Sharif, Executive Director, ED of UN Habitat, and Dr. Matt Benson from Think City. After the break, innovative ways to access capital to enable sustainable urbanization. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas, powered by U Mobile.
Welcome back. On The Breakfast Grill, I'm in conversation with Maimouna Mohammed Sharif, United Nations Under Secretary General and Executive Director of UN Habitat, who we affectionately call as ED, and Dr. Matt Benson, a Program Director for Think City, and who is a member of the International Advisory Board for the World Cities Report 2020, as we understand the latest shifts in how we live in cities following the pandemic. So far, the conversation we've had so far has been very much focused on how concepts of urbanization are changing, and we also have had some idea about some potential ideas on how we can solve them. And I think we've been able to pass out that there are many challenges, but also we have some idea about the different right models. But I guess it all comes back to money, isn't it? It all comes back to the capital. As we edge out from the pandemic and you've seen governments everywhere struggle with their own public finances, do you see that the urbanization agenda is going to be deprioritized by governments simply because they have lack of capital?
Okay, the capital here, I would like to put it into two. capital in terms of dollar and cent, and also capital in terms of human resource, capital in terms of knowledge and talent. Sometimes we have the dollar and cent, but without the capital, the human resource, you cannot implement the project directly and get the impact, the actual impact. So when you look at the urbanization, and yes, capital is important, but we need leadership. For example, there is globally. Many of these asked a question in World Economic Forum during the business. I said that you are a big businessman. Where do you want to put your money? He said that to the place which have the enabling environment, good governance. It's not lack of capital. The capital is there. So we need a good governance for us to invest. So the challenge is it now in every city have to look into the, I think about the three things. Leadership. Leadership is very important. Sincere and have visionary leadership. You want link to the people to improve the quality of life for the people. Second is governance. We need a governance. We need a rules and procedure. We need, for example, you said just now, urban planning is there. The planning is there. But the action, does it follow whatever is on the ground? Is it follow what we've been planned, been gazetted?
Yes.
That's linked to governance. So I think, and then the third part is only capital. So I think this, the leadership, governance and capital is very, very important to push forward. We cannot blame urbanization. Urbanization is there to stay.
So the sequencing is very key. Leadership, governance, and then only capital. But that's the fundamental problem, isn't it? When you look at private capital, there's good private capital and there's bad private capital. And especially in Malaysia, we have seen a lot of examples of bad private capital that have broken governance, and as a result, it is misused, and as a result, we have urban plans that don't work, isn't it? That's one of the biggest challenges. How do you discern and decide that private capital, for many of our listeners, are very frustrated. They see all these private capital interfering into the process of urban planning. How do we stop that?
It's an interesting and challenging question there. I want to bring it back to a project that we are working with you and Habitat, because I think it might offer some potential solutions. Part of the reason why private capital is there is because we don't have public capital to do the right thing. Okay, and why don't we have public capital? Multiple reasons. There's certainly finance out there, but I think one of them is that the great ideas that are out there, and there are many, many, many of them in local governments, in NGOs, they don't have the capacity or the knowledge to make them investable or bankable. These are sort of some language that is out there. So how do we take all those great sustainable projects that are out there in the minds of planning officers and mayors out there, and how do we get them to access sustainable finance? There's plenty of money. We can get money for projects, but as you know, money often comes with strings. So how do we make those strings sustainable strings? So one of the brainchilds of ED here when she first, and correct me if I'm misspeaking here, ED, which is that when you first arrived in UN Habitat, you asked your team, why so many plans? Where's the action? And so from that sort of statement, they ideated this principle, this concept of a city's investment facility.
Right.
And so we've been working with many other partners, with UN Habitat, to establish a platform where cities can actually access sustainable finance and also access the knowledge and know-how around that to get their ideas and projects to a point where it's palatable for these financiers, who many of who have, and through that process, we can actually vet the initiative to make sure they are meeting the SDGs, and we can put the UN Habitat chop on them so the financiers know, hey, this is from a social impact point of view, I know I'm doing good, doing right by the people on the planet, and the cities know, well, I'm getting access to capital that is also going to work with me as a partner.
So very interesting point, because this marries to the frustration you had, right, Edie, that people plan but they don't execute. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they don't have the expertise to execute. They don't have the expertise to access private capital. And in the end, invariably, what happens is because they don't have any expertise, they rely on these bad actors to then make all these terrible judgment plans, which they have no choice to then capitulate and follow, right? So how is the progress of this city investments facility? How is the rollout been?
We have an urban lab in UN Habitat. And I went down and I saw all the plans, all very colourful plans. Colourful plans. I saw one of the plans at the time is Kisumu plan, the waterfront development in Kisumu, one of the cities in Kenya. Then I said, after this plan, what happened? Oh, ED, we will give it to the mayor. Yes, after that, after the mayor, oh, we don't know. Then I said, is that only our duty to colour all this plan? And then after that, we don't implement it? So it's up to the mayor to implement. Then I talked to the mayor. What are you going to do with this plan? He said, ED, I don't have the capacity to do it. I don't have the people with this plan. I cannot cannot come up with a concept and also a project paper that is bankable. I cannot get the development partners or investors to invest because I don't know. So we had a workshop. Then I came up with this cities investment platform to use UN Habitat as a platform for these people or the mayors who have a plan. So we launched it in the World Urban Forum 10 in Abu Dhabi. At that time, it's only 32. And then it's 12 was discussed very lengthy. And then now we have already in Malaysia, I think we have two, one in Penang, one is Iskandar. It's within this cities investment platform.
Right.
And we're already in the World Urban Forum 11 in Katowice, 64 cities came. And we have a development partners came to discuss the matching. But what we did, what we are doing now in UN Habitat is that not only like matchmake, but we also matchmake with indicators. We came out with the SDG certification, meaning that if you follow this, we are not only doing that, okay, this is the plan, this is the investor, you do. But we guide so that they will achieve the SDG indicators. So they will be a green city, will be sustainable, inclusive. So we came out with the SDG certification. If this city is certified as SDG compliance, then we will attract the green investor because we want green recovery. So green investors, then they said that they will be have the governance, we have the guidelines for them to develop a trust between the development partners and UN Habitat and also the mayors so they can implement.
So if I just look at our urban infrastructure financing gap in its excess of US $3.2 trillion, it's incredible, eye-watering amount, Matt. I mean, Edie was talking about, you know, these 12 concepts taking place and hopefully go to 64, great, but this has to scale up very, very fast. How do we scale this up to the point that we can meet this infrastructure gap and do it with the right leadership, with the proper governance in place?
Well, I think, yeah, you're right. 12 is a good, modest start, but we need to scale this. And I think ED and ourselves are very aware of that. But there's only so much two organisations can do, right? It has to be demonstrate what is possible to use the platform. And we're linking to other UN agencies to sort of link into their projects and use the network approach to scale this. I think also the other part where we can scale it is that by creating value for corporations, right? This idea of value creation, SDGs, etc. So creating value for UN, creating value for cities, but also making sure the investors are also getting value. And by value, I mean beyond the financial value, right? The value in terms of brand, the value in terms of doing right, the value in terms of pivoting their organizations or whatever to not invest in carbon positive type projects. So I think there's something there that will demonstrate to investors how they can also take this example here, learn from it, and then apply it in other forums that may not be part of the UN system. So I think that may be some of the ideas of how this might be scaled. But you're absolutely right. I think the ambition there is 500 or 1,000 cities with UN Habitat in the next sort of few years. But you know, I don't know how many cities around the world, but a lot more than 1,000. But you know, it's not the job of UN Habitat to do every city, right? It's to demonstrate, to build knowledge, to share, etc. So I think all credibility to UN Habitat for doing that.
And Edie, what do you think is the biggest challenge cities all around the world have underestimated so far?
Leadership, because many of the cities around the world, they need a strong leader. To me, it's leadership. We need a strong leader who believe in implementing the new urban agenda, who believe in the SDG, who believe in the people. I think many of the countries, they have no money, they have no funding. But with leadership, I can see a city called Freetown, a good mayor, the Yvonne, and she said that she has no money. She has a lot of problem, a lot of slum. But with their leadership in the belief and we put in all the action plan, people coming in to help her because they know that she's serious. She really meant what she said. So it's to me, it's the challenges now is the leadership.
On this special extended Breakfast Grill, we are in panel discussion with Maimuna Mohammed Sharif, United Nations Under Secretary General and Executive Director of UN Habitat, who we affectionately call as ED, and Dr. Matt Benson, a Program Director for Think City, and is a member of the International Advisory Board for the World Cities Report 2020. After the 8:30 news bulletin, how does urban planning respond to societal opportunities and challenges? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to this special extended Breakfast Grill. With me is Maimuna Mohammed Sharif, Executive Director of UN Habitat, and Dr. Matt Benson, Program Director for Think City, on leadership required to build resilient cities.
You know, Edie, I understand, you know, you haven't been back to Malaysia for a very long time, and that one of the perks of, you know, coming from Penang is that you're actually very close to many farms, particularly durian farms. I guess the question is, how do you see urban farms and agriculture kind of work interplay with urban planning moving forward then?
I think to me, there are few categories of urban farm. One is in the city, where there is a lot of public spaces, unused land that is been used for the purpose of the farming, but even in Penang and also in Kuala Lumpur, when I visited the River of Life project, where they put a lot of farming along the river, now is systematically. I think that is good. But another one is the commercial farm. The commercial farm have to be regulated and at the same time not to give adverse impact to the environment. I think this is very important for us. As I said, that if you have a plan, you have to put right, implement the plan. If the plan is stated that there is a forest reserve, then it should be forest reserve. And the plan should be gazetted.
Mm.
And gazetted, it should be, and this is what I believe in that. One is it gazetted because the Town and Country Planning Act, going back with my experience as a town planner, there is a there to the process for public participation and all that. So the people power is very, very important. If you have a transparent, you have a plan. If this area is meant for durian plantation, it's meant for durian plantation.
Yep.
If this area is meant for forest reserve, by all means put it as forest reserve. So if it's changed, then if the plan is gazetted and is given very transparent to the public can act on that. So I think it's very important to do have a transparency.
So I think the transparency is quite key to tackle some of these key challenges like food security and supply that even cities now have to tackle, right? It's not a national issue now, an issue that has to be actually tackled on a local level, at a city level. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the national level issues that perhaps now the cities have not yet taken on at the level which they have the power to do? They can actually harness some really good energy to tackle some of the national issues. Yeah.
Well, I think I think the 10th Malaysia Plan recognised the importance of cities. So, you know, it's been embedded into national policy. I think probably from my perspective, probably what we fully haven't understood is how the networks of cities can work together.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a very esoteric concept, but, you know, often what we find in Malaysia is the cities are almost competing against one another.
Yeah.
Right. And really what the cities should be doing is complementing their functions from one another. I'm just going to take Perak as an example. Not Perak, don't get me wrong, but you know, often the cities there, they've got the same functions, and really they should be looking at their special qualities and creating a system of cities, sort of like what we might call it a city region. So they talk about in the olden days the competition was between nations, and then they started talking about it was competition between cities. Well, I would say actually it's about city regions.
Mm.
Right? So how do the natural kind of cohesion or identity of cities in Johor or
coalesce and
sort of function together,
yeah.
Right? Rather than, you know, so working together as a network, as a neural network, if you like, as a single entity. I think that's the key. I don't think that's a concept that really has been grasped at any levels of government.
But it goes back to the square one conversation we had about intermediary cities, about how the intermediary cities and also the primary cities have to work very closely together.
Yeah.
They're so complementary, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's why I said that when we have these intermediary cities, they should be complement to each other.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be competing because they have different roles, the metropolitan or the city. Cities is a different role. Then intermediary cities, they cannot be competing. And I'm staying here. I want to be as big as Kuala Lumpur. Want to be as big, whatever it's Kuala Lumpur Taiping. But in terms of services, they should be the same, but in different scale. For example, if Kuala Lumpur have a bank, Taiping should have a bank. Kuala Lumpur have a hospital, Taiping also have a good hospital. Good. That's where is good urbanization is. Urbanization is not coming to the city, but urbanization is that what I understand is that whatever facilities that you can get in the central, in the metropolitan, you should also get in intermediary cities. You also get at the small town and also at the village. That's why they got clinic desa and all that. So you can have a hierarchy. So I think this is where urbanization is all about. Not all coming to the city.
Not
center.
A congregation already,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That's I think what people are saying.
Yeah.
And that's why people have this whole perception of, you know, with congregation comes economic density, which comes this whole idea of these mega structures. I mean, we celebrate these skyscrapers and such. That's not how we celebrate city success going forward anymore, do we? We don't think of these concrete monuments as measures of success for cities going forward, do we?
Well, again, I wouldn't say it's a clear answer. Yeah, I mean, in some cases, you know, maybe these things are necessary. In some cases, these developments are underway. So, you know, what do? Do we just abandon these buildings? I don't think that's right. Yeah,
practical.
So we need practical. So we need to think practically how we actually. But I think you're right. There will be a revisiting of the nature of the types of buildings that we have, the function, their purpose. The idea of just a, you know, mega tower that's just offices, I think, is gone.
Yeah.
I think it'll be more about middle rise in suburban, human centric, people centric, human scale developments in this polycentric network of spaces we spoke about at the beginning. But I think, I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, you're sure a lot of these developments, skyscrapers, are about investment and in the plot and people making money, but they're also about the identity of a city and you know, the skyline, everything. It does matter. You know, you can't say it doesn't matter. You know, does it matter more than the sewerage and the basic service? Well, no. Yeah, I think the identity and the role that skyscrapers and such have played in the past is going to continue. I think things about, you know, how much carbon they're using are going to become critical type.
And you know, Edie, as we end and conclude this discussion, right, you've traveled all around the world. Which city, in your view so far, has exemplified this role model of thinking ahead, being ahead of the curve, but still able to retain its identity so well?
Okay, I have two cities. I just came back from Katowice, Poland, where we had World Urban Forum there. In the early years, this city was a coal mining, very, very dirty cities, and UN Habitat involved in the planning of this urban regeneration, and now become a very cultural, very vibrant cities. And they say that this, what they did was that is putting back all the facilities. I'm always going to the community and people. I don't know, because it's in my heart. They say it's people. They are putting up urban regeneration with the people. Second is Vienna. Vienna is also very, very interesting cities. They have the moderns. They also have the heritage and the public spaces integrated with the public transport. And I have the opportunity to visit Vienna. And recently, it was a pleasant surprise that the Vienna mayors, the Vienna cities, won the Lee Kuan Yew Award just recently. So I went the beginning of the year. I said, wow, this city is going to be one of the example of good planning. Then I realized that they won the Lee Kuan Yew Award. So I think my judgment is correct. You know, I went there earlier. So I think there's two cities that I really admire.
And Matt, which cities do you admire the most?
Well, I'm biased, so I have to say Penang, right?
Oh, yes. Well, for sure, right? For its good food and such. Why do you like Penang so much?
I like the smaller. I like the community. I like the fact that people from Penang are mostly from Penang. You know, sometimes in the larger cities, you know, it's the nature of the game, right? But in a larger city, you know, the sense of community.
They're very proud of the identity.
They're very proud of their identity.
Regardless of where they come from, they're proud of the identity of Penang.
Correct. So I think I kind of like that. Yeah. I like the nature, of course. And of course, the heritage and the grit of the city, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm biased. My wife's from Penang.
But if you ask me locally in Malaysia, Penang is the top.
Of course, lah.
Yeah. Penang.
After heading soon for a durian feast.
Because you were asking me globally, that is the top. But you called it locally in Malaysia.
That was my intentional trap. Edie and Matt, thank you for spending your time with us on the Breakfast Grill. Maimuna Muhammad Sharif, Executive Director of UN Habitat, and Dr. Matt Benson, a Program Director for Think City on building livable cities all around the world. I'm Philip C., BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, where unlimited potential begins.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.